Hello and welcome to episode number 7 of Android Developers Backstage. I am Chet Haas on the Android Framework and Toolkit team.
And I'm Tor Norby on the Tools team.
And today we have...
I'm Kirill Grushnikov. I work on the Google Play Store app for the last about 4 years.
All right then. I'm glad you said your name because I actually never knew how to pronounce your last name, and now I do. I'm not going to pronounce it correctly. So I'll just avoid it. So we're talking to Kirill today, mostly because I bumped into him 2 days ago, because he's on campus. He normally works remotely.
Yeah, that was unfortunate.
But before he could run away, we decided that it would be interesting to talk to him, not directly because he works on Play Store, but more because of the things that they do on Play Store and large apps in general. To do things that scale across releases and devices, and Kirill, you do a lot of design stuff, taking mocks from designers and integrating that in and getting nice motion experiences, and you play a lot with UI elements, you give talks on this stuff, so it seemed interesting to talk about that kind of stuff. Maybe we'll talk about Play Store as well, but that's kind of a second priority.
Okay, is that a question?
No, so that's all the time that we had today.
It's been great.
Okay, good talk.
That was like the largest intro paragraph ever. So where do we start with this? Tell us the dynamic of developing for Play Store, which is basically a huge app, very data-driven, very dynamic, and has, I don't know, lots of different requirements because of all the versions you have to run on.
What versions do you support?
So we started originally from Cupcake, so it was part of the original Cupcake release, and then we dropped Donut and Eclair about 3 years ago, and now we go back to Froyo. Okay. So we go to Froyo, Gingerbread, Honeycomb, Ice Cream Sandwich, Jelly Bean, Kit Kat.
Okay, so that's probably about as large a release span as anybody has.
I think with that you cover something like 99% of the versions that check into the Play Store. Although I guess that would be sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you drop everything except Jelly Bean, then 100% of devices checking into the Play Store would be Jelly Bean.
So basically, Play Store is the reason that we're held back to these releases. Is that what you're saying?
Specifically for me, I see kind of these two big groups of, if you will, device profiles. Before Honeycomb and after Honeycomb. So supporting Froyo and Gingerbread is pretty much the same as far as the API surface, the public API surface that we are using. And then Honeycomb, and after that, we are using platform APIs to do transitions, animations.
Action
and then maybe jumping a little bit forward in the questions, we use support library very extensively.
Yep.
To get something like ViewPager and Fragments and SideDrawer and ActionBar.
Do you use AppCompat as well?
Not at the present. So a lot of other Play apps already switched to ActionBar, and we have.
So you have some homegrown stuff.
Yeah, we have our own wrapper because, in general, if you look at the support library, there's no magic in it, in the sense that it's using. Pretty much the same APIs that are available to app developers. It's just wrapping them in a nice way. Yeah. And we've carried our own ActionBar implementation for about 2 years mm-hmm. before it was available in the support library. But we should really be switching to that to be more consistent mm-hmm. internally and externally.
Mm-hmm. So actually, for people that don't know, let's pretend for a moment that's me. Support library, like the place where we put all this stuff, contains both support library and app compat stuff.
It's two separate kind of library projects, if you will. Support library, from what I understand, is mostly about. Maybe you should ask Adam Powell as your next guest how they decide to kind of split functionality between support library and app compat. So ActionBar specifically is an app compat, and then you have Fragments and ViewPager and SideDrawer and a whole bunch of other stuff in the support library.
Okay, right. I think app compat is basically doing exactly what it says. It's basically like compatibility on all the platforms for things that are in the platform, whereas I think support library has things that aren't in the platform, like the ViewPager and things mm-hmm. like that.
Except you said Frameworks is in support library, not
Fragments.
Fragments.
Yeah, they are in support library.
Okay, but they're also in the platform.
Yeah, so I think that because that predates app compat.
Okay, so I mean, my understanding of App Compatter, the parts I've used, are it's a way to sort of shim into platform capabilities when they exist or do something else on older platforms, and sometimes that's a no-op, right? So we may have some view property that we've exposed in Honeycomb, and if you happen to call a setter, it'll do the right thing on Honeycomb in the later releases, and then in earlier releases, it won't do anything at all. I guess the distinction between that approach, which is the App Compat approach, and the support library approach is when you're using a support library, that's all you get, right? We're not actually going down and using platform capabilities. Is that
we should have better, episode 8 on the support library.
Okay, this is actually, all of this was just an elaborate scam to provide a nice segue to the next episode. So now we're going to just start playing.
I'm here to pimp your next guest.
That's right. So we actually talked about having Adam on the show anyway, but I think this motivates it even more. Okay, so you use support library for what kind of capabilities?
So we're using ViewPager very heavily.
Yep.
Pretty much when you go from our main landing page to apps, to movies, to books, and you can swipe left and right, and there's multiple charts, like trending, top new paid, whatever, top 100 movies and whatnot. So this is ViewPager, and we use it extensively. We've recently switched pretty much all top-level navigation to the side drawer, in general, in the Play Store and in general across a lot of apps that you see from Google, from Play and from Google. We use Fragments to kind of separate our screens and support nice transitions between them. And here and there, maybe a little bit support for right-to-left languages with like Gravity Compat, or some fancy window modes with window compat, like little bits and pieces. And what's nice, we are using ProGuard, which is I recommend everybody to use. It essentially strips away parts of those libraries that you're using that, like if you take a library such as a support library and you use, let's say 50% of that, ProGuard effectively strips out everything that you're not using. And it's nice to keep the binary size down, to utilize less of the network when people get their Play Store updated.
Right. We heard the same recommendation when we had a chat with the Guava folks in a different context, and they were saying the same thing, because Guava itself is huge, right? You don't want the entire thing, but if you want just a small part of it, use ProGuard.
Right. So you can kind of opt into using a small part as an app developer. You can opt in to use a small part of the support library and not be too much worried about what's the impact on your binary size. The more you use, the more it's the incremental increase in your app size the more you start using support library.
Yeah, though I'm not certain that it strips out resources and assets.
Right. It can only strip away Java code.
Yeah.
But the good thing about support library is that, as far as I know, Adam would know better, as far as I know, it doesn't actually have any heavy strings or images or like any heavy resources.
The support library doesn't have any of that. It is not actually an Android project. It is just pure code, whereas the compat library and the media router and the grid layout, those have resources.
Right.
So app compat does pull in quite a bit of assets, but you need those for your action bar.
Right.
Okay, so that's the use of support library, and then the reason you do that is you can run across multiple releases, but sometimes there are capabilities that you want that don't necessarily exist. So you said one of the differences in these buckets that you had is, in Honeycomb you have animation capabilities and some other platform niceties that we added at that time, and then prior to that, there's different animation APIs or just not the same capabilities. Mm-hmm. So what do you do? How do you degrade? Mm.
What we usually do in these cases, if it's not nicely exposed by the support library, we look at, you have this build class that exposes the current system version that you're running, and
build
it has
.os version.
Yeah, something build version, build version codes. Yeah. So you can use that to know which platform version you're running on. Mm-hmm. And effectively you can create, and this is what a support library does as well internally, you look and say, okay, am I on Honeycomb, am I on ICS, am I on Jelly Bean? And if so, I can use this nice animation API or nice transition API to behave nicely. Mm-hmm. And you fall back let's call it, gracefully degrade on older devices in a sense that you don't crash. That's the most important one.
I like the not crashing capability.
So that would be kind of the most important one. And so instead of, let's say, if you remove something from your list view on ICS and Jelly Bean and KitKat devices, we fade it out, we fade that view out, and we kind of smoothly collapse the list view around it. Mm-hmm. And on older platform releases, it just snaps immediately. So it's not that nice a transition, but it's still, like, you know, first of all, it doesn't crash. And second, it doesn't like throw you out of that stream. You stay in the stream. It's not as nice, but it's the best we can do for that particular kind of interaction experience.
So do you do this switching solely on versions, or do you also have a notion of high-end devices and low-end devices and doing fewer animations on?
Not at the present.
Okay.
Not at the present because we are not that animation heavy yet.
Okay.
So we mostly use our animations to, like, you know, inside the stream, if you start interacting, we have this thing where you can rate a certain item, and then we kind of slide in recommended items based on that. So we have these animations here and there, but it's not as heavy as, let's say, the Play Music app,
right,
which has very nice transitions between the screens. So in general, something like media-oriented, we are more about searching and browsing and buying content instead of consuming it.
Right. So you mentioned the list example a second ago. That's something I remember. I used to be very annoyed. You know, I would go through my apps list and I would delete things that, you know, my kids had installed that I wanted to be gone from my history completely. And, you know, after I'd scroll down five pages and deleted something, it would jump back to the top.
Right.
And that's something that's fixed recently, right?
Right. So that's been fixed.
Was that difficult? And is that something that app developers can do in their own lists?
That's been fixed recently in our latest stable release, 4.6. Mm-hmm. 4.6, we are now on 4.6.17. It's not difficult in the sense that if you have, 100 people working on your app, you just throw more people at the problem. It was just never prioritized highly.
Okay.
Or was it just a way to get users to just look at the top of their list again? No, really, we think you're going to really enjoy the things at the top of your list.
Like, you know, it's in general, you have this kind of trade-off where you have let's call them small set of very vocal users that use your app very heavily. Specifically in this case, you have people like tech bloggers installing hundreds of thousands of apps, and then they have this list to manage. And of course, for them, it's a very bad experience. And then you have
even with 100 apps, it was pretty annoying.
Right. I'm not saying that we've been handling this in a good way, but it's
I think the thing I was interested in is, you know, for app developers who have list views with more than 50 items in them, you know, is there some recommendation we can give them, or you could give them advice for how you preserve the user's position, mm-hmm, you know, when you are making edits to that list? Because that seems like the kind of usability, mm-hmm, that people should work on when they have lists.
Right, so you have these methods that you override on save instance state and on restore instance state. We were just not storing the correct information about that particular page, about that particular list.
So I assume the deletion then was something that launched some other activity. And so when you returned to your first activity, you needed to go, oh, well, now we have to recreate the list.
No, it remained in the same place, except that if you start scrolling through that list, we start bringing more chunks of data, let's say in chunks of 10 or 12 or 15 or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then when you start removing stuff in the middle, there you get into this like technical implementation details, like management of these chunks, and like storing where your start index for the next chunk.
Because is like an infinite scroll.
Yeah,
so it's
and then you start removing stuff from the first few chunks, and there's a lot of kind of our internal maintenance, but that really is our internal problem in the way of, in the sense that how we manage to bring that data.
Okay.
So it's not for, if you have simpler list, it's not, I wouldn't say it's not that hard, but it was just a little bit overcomplicated on our side.
Right.
So if there's a takeaway from this, could we say that data is hard?
Yes.
Okay, so data is hard. Was there any particular, I think maybe what Tori was driving at, was there any particular limitation of list view itself that made that particularly tricky, or it was more the other things involved in
the application? No, it was more on the side of bringing the data and paginating and keeping track when you start removing stuff from the previous pages.
Right, and I think also just sort of like a note to usability check your own apps to make sure that these kinds of, you know, list operations preserve. Because it's so easy when we write apps to test with our simple data, where you're always deleting from one of the items available on the screen. You don't tend to scroll to the bottom of the screen 6 pages in and then make some edit to it and seeing what the usability is there. Mm-hmm. You keeping score again?
Well, I'm keeping notes because it turns out that I don't actually remember anything.
If I just the last piece. In general, as an app developer working on your app, like, you know, day in and day out for years, I'm not crying. So you get kind of, you have to be aware that you have these like ugly spots, and you kind of get used to them in a sense. Mm-hmm. And you say, yeah, well, just it's like it's this minor thing. And of course, your users see it in a completely different way. So that's like, as an app developer, we should not fall into this trap of familiarity. And I just have that nice workaround of, like, you know, rotating the screen just at the right moment. And
right. So you become blind to it because it's just right. You accept it.
So,
for what it is.
Like, unfortunately for that specific scenario, we kind of fallen into this blind trap.
Fortunately, users are there to just beat us up constantly.
Right, right.
Remind us of all the things that we'd really rather forget.
Yeah, what kind of rating does the Play Store itself have on the Play Store?
So, nice thing.
Who watches The Watchmen?
Nice thing is that we, although it's been in Honeycomb, we kind of published kind of this APK of the store on the store itself, which was a little bit unfortunate. And people could have rated it. I don't remember like what the rating was, but in general, Play Store itself is kind of a special, unique, beautiful snowflake in the sense that it's not listed on the store, so you cannot rate it, which is okay. We have other venues to see what people think. All bunch of tech blogs and forums and people stopping me randomly on the street.
And punching you?
So that's why
not
I kind
so
of live
anymore.
In the basement most of the time.
So it actually, that application in particular probably went through more revolution since I've been here for the last 4 years than other Google apps in terms of there was Market and then it got rewritten and rebranded and then it was Play Store and then it got rewritten again. There's like at least 3 rewrites that I know of just since I've been here.
Right, so for me personally, it feels like I've been on 3 separate projects. Mm-hmm. That indeed it was, so on the very external kind of surface, it was rebranded from Android Market to Google Play, I think maybe 2.5 years ago. Mm-hmm. And then on a more pixel level, we've had this kind of a facelift where I called it Green Goblin, where we had these green swooshes. And then when we rebranded it to Google Play, we've revisited in general how we expose information with, like, you know, cards and multiple streams side by side. And then about a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago, we did another big rewrite with cards and clusters and streams. And you know, there was this commercial, there was like this airplane flying and people just like, you know, fixing it in flight. And sometimes it feels that way, that we are on this release schedule when we do maybe like every 2 months. We have a new release of the store, and in every release we're rewriting this big part of the application. And still, like, you know, in every release we should provide pretty much, like, we should not regress, not crash, and not take too much features away from the users because apparently they don't like it. And it's we cannot just take, like, you know, a 1 year break and like do a big redesign. And we kind of been doing this in kind of this very quick iterations.
So how do you make sure you don't break things?
Well, for one thing, I think he said before that they use the don't crash support library.
Yeah. Yes.
So that, I mean, that, and then that compatibly scales to all the releases. Mm. So that's step one.
Check. Yeah, you're done.
We have this kind of multiple rounds of testing. What is available to external developers, or external in the sense that if you are, like, you know, a developer in the Android ecosystem, on the pub site in the listing of your app, you can do alpha group, alpha testing group, beta testing group, and then you can do what we call phased rollouts. You can say, okay, this is my release APK, I've signed it, I'm ready to go, and instead of going straight to 100% of your user base, you say, okay, I'm going to start with 5%, then 10%.
I see. So basically, you check in, and then you basically the external users, 5% of them are that's your test suite. That's how you find out if you broke something.
For us, we do something very similar. So the team itself, our team, the Play Store team, we are always running the development, the latest development builds, and then we have kind of if you look at alpha, beta, gamma, and whatnot. So at some point we say, okay, we are ready to go to slightly larger, let's say, play group. Mm-hmm. And then we go to slightly larger Android group. And then we go to the entire Google group. And then at that point where we have this kind of three levels of alpha, beta, gamma testing inside Google, then we do we sign the APK. And we do stage rollouts. We used to start at 1%. Now we start at 5%, but it doesn't really matter. Mm-hmm. The main goal is to fish out very bad things that have slipped through these multiple rounds of internal testing.
Right. I mean, I would suspect that internal testing probably are going to be using more modern devices on maybe on larger screens, whereas maybe in the field you get lots of people still on Froyo devices with LDPI.
Right. So we have people who get paid to test our app. They're called testers, or QA. Mm-hmm. So they have a large variety of devices. From if we go back to Froyo, they have Froyo devices, they have Gingerbread devices,
right,
and they have Honeycomb and so on. So every so they know what we're working on,
right,
new features that we're adding, or existing features that we are tweaking, or bugs that we're fixing, and they make sure that however much humanly possible is to cover manually, and we have a few automated tests as well. So it's never 100% proof. I mean, whoever thinks that they write code without bugs, or that their QA team catches all of the bugs, is just delusional.
I think Tor actually writes bug free.
So Tor is delusional. That would be the logical conclusion.
But do you write tests as well? I mean, because you focus mainly on UI, is that true?
Right.
And that's a very challenging part to test.
You do what you can. So you always have the underlying layers of caching, database, network, connectivity, cache. Caching, I already told, like manipulating data. So those bits where you have a very well-defined expected result of what should happen after I call this method, you test as much as you can. And then, of course, you cannot test something. This stream should collapse smoothly when you remove something from it. So that would be maybe possible to test if you throw a lot of people like chat at it. Test the frame rate, test that at every single position, it doesn't start jumping erratically on the screen.
Right.
But you have to you have to cut line at some point and say, okay, it's touching pixels. Most probably it's not worth investing time in trying to automate those.
You basically
types
assume
of tests
that the framework does what it's supposed to.
Yes, and also human eye is a very good tester in that sense. If it's not smooth, it catches dropped frames pretty good. Right. If you don't fall into this trap of let's just ignore that for a second.
So we talked about scaling releases, and you go all the way back to Froyo, but the other important thing you do is scale device form factors, right? Because this thing has to look really good and present content in a reasonable way no matter what device people are using. You're not locking it into portrait mode on phones.
No. So, yes. Are you done with the question? Sorry.
I didn't get to the question mark, but let's say, how do you do that?
So back when I started in late 2009, it was Nexus One was just about to be announced, and back then we had only phones, and I think Dell Streak 5 was just around the corner, maybe in 2010-ish timeframe. So that was kind of a scary thing to get into. Suddenly we have this larger screen to talk about. And then of course we had a couple of 7-inch devices, early 7-inch devices from I don't remember, maybe like one from Samsung. I don't remember like the code names or whatever. And then we had Zoom, and then we had the explosion of form factors, 10-inch devices, 7-inch devices, and pretty much everything in between. So yes, it's foremost a design challenge to scale the presentation of your information, to scale the browsing, searching, and purchase flow specifically for us, and you know, media consumption and whatnot, like mapping experience with navigating and whatnot, Gmail. So pretty much any app has its own unique set of design requirements to scale from a 3-inch device to a 10-inch device and everything in between. And this is what we did about 2 years ago. It took about, I think, 3 or 4 months for our PMs and UX designers to come up with this new framework, design framework of how to present information on this variety of screens, and do something that makes sense, that feels comfortable on that specific device, like, you know, not to cram too much information on a smaller screen and not to artificially stretch it and have a lot of white space on larger screens. So that's foremost a design kind of thing. And then it comes to the implementation, where, if I may allow myself to praise your team, Chet's team.
I'm okay with that.
And Diane's team, we have a very very capable mechanism to, let's call it with these resource qualifiers and whatnot, to be able to scale the UI on a very high level, on the layout level with fragments, or like, you know, put stuff side by side, down to very low level, like, you know, using slightly larger font sizes on larger devices and whatnot, to effectively scale the same piece of UI to the metrics of the screen, to the resolution, to the size, to the platform capabilities, and right to left orientation and whatnot. So then it becomes a kind of back and forth between the designers and developers to see how much sense each static design, where they create this, like, you know, static set of static mocks, and you put them on the screen and you say, yes, it makes sense. No, it's like the transitions don't make sense. And then you go back and forth within the capabilities of the platform. You don't want to start bending it too much, because you don't want to start down the road of like, you know, going against the grain of the platform guidelines.
Can you talk more about that process of, you know, how you go from some UI designer's idea to actual, you know, implementation?
Mm-hmm. So I try to kind of break it down into the set of modules, if you will. So I have this, my kind of like, the inside voice kind of, let's break it down to this collection of Lego blocks. Mm-hmm. And see, so you get this set of designs. This is your new screen. This is how it looks like on a phone. This is how it looks like on a larger screen, let's say 7-inch landscape or 10-inch portrait landscape. So you try to identify those blocks. So how you kind of implement those blocks on the layout level, on the code level, encapsulate that.
I'm trying to understand where the term block or module comes from the UI design. I mean, is that, you're saying you're parameterizing what they've done into sort of a generic...
You mean block like fragment, like
no block. If you take a look at something like a details page for a movie or an application on the store, so you have a block, the summary section that shows the application icon, and if you like buy button or install button, then you have a block of screenshots, then you have a block of reviews, a block of similar apps, a block of contact developer, send an email to his mother to tell her that he's doing really great job and whatnot. So these are blocks in the sense of like the layout blocks.
Like a page design, you would say, like in some frame maker or something, like here's a frame that I want to contain this. And so then you can go in and implement those. Those would map to implementation, and that's why you're doing this.
Right, okay. So I'm trying to identify these blocks that can be implemented in a certain like standalone way. And then on a higher level to compose them, maybe on a phone it will be a single column layout, and on a tablet it will be maybe a two column layout. And then if you look at our streams where you have these cards and clusters, so each cluster I would consider a block. where it can and it should adapt to smaller or larger screens, in the sense that on a smaller screen maybe it will use three smaller cards, and on a larger 10-inch device it will use six cards side by side, and each card is slightly larger and it will display a little bit more information because you have that space to play with. So this is when I'm talking about blocks. I'm talking about like layout blocks, trying to kind of to break it down into this kind of nested layers of layout, and handle each layer
are
separately.
These things you think you would map to fragments later then, so you can say that in a tablet you have each block.
Well, it seems like fragment is at a larger level because
yeah,
you've got these
right.
several blocks
fragment
within
contains,
the screen. So
right,
it's
at a much higher level when you actually combine the blocks together, and then fragment is on the level of more like the screen.
Yeah,
so they're like fragments of fragments.
Yeah, we don't have nested fragments. I'm just trying to create these blocks, which are kind of these black boxes where you say, okay,
yep.
This is your main document. Like if you talk about something like screenshots block on the app details page. Mm-hmm. So you say, this is the data model that you have as your source. Now look at this specific subset of the data in that model and take care of everything. If there's a video element, add a video element. If there are multiple screenshots, show all of them.
So
and
I guess
then
this comes about because you have a very data-driven UI.
Right.
Okay.
It seems like one of the tricks too in you know getting the mocks from UX and figuring out how to implement it is how to implement it in a way that the code scales across all the different form factors. Like yeah, you can make you know an awesome looking tablet app, but if it doesn't actually reuse the code for implementing these blocks and the fragments and the layouts with what you've got on the phone, then all of a sudden you've got multiple teams mm-hmm. managing forked source. Mm-hmm.
Right, so what I'm trying to do is for each individual block to be as flexible as possible as far as utilizing the space that is given to it. So the same block on, once again, screenshots. So it should fit as many images as possible within its width, so that when you put it on a small screen or on a large screen, it just gracefully scales to whatever space you give it. Essentially, U is just kind of the next layer in the layout hierarchy.
So it sounds like you do some custom layout managers or view groups. Do you have any custom views other than that?
I love those, yes. So we have kind of this basic collection of layouts. We have linear layout, relative layout.
Wait, that sounds familiar.
Absolute layout. Come on, fist bump.
What?
Fist bump
what?
For absolute layout? No,
not
fist
for
bump.
Absolute. No.
Okay, so and then we have tablet, table layout, grid layout, and whatnot. And I really love working with pixels. So every time I have an opportunity to ditch the core layouts and do my own measure layout pass, it's pretty much the best part of my day. So you know,
is that what you mean by the word pixel pushing? Because I personally don't know what that means. Can you for our listeners?
It's a Russian
what
term.
What is
it means
pixel pushing?
Pixels.
So it's just pretty much kind of it's my opportunity to vent about whatever happens when I work without jeopardizing my employment too much.
Yeah, I wanted to talk to you about that after the podcast.
So in general, no, it's general like. It's kind of whatever comes up during the day, which I try to like vent my frustration, so find amusing where like, you know, I see these like, ugly parts where hopefully it's just like, you know, not specific to me, but in general, like part of our craft, like, you know, coding craft, like, you know, whatever we do to get money.
For people that have no idea what he's talking about, Kirill pushes posts on G+, pretty much constantly.
Yeah, like three, four a day.
Hashtags them as pixel pushing.
Yeah, they're all tagged pixel pushing, and I was just wondering if that wasn't what that verb means. It sounds like it just means complaining about stuff in our industry related
it
to
didn't
pixels.
It used to, right? Pixel pushing was your blog, wasn't it? Where you posted design stuff?
It is still. Like this kind of series started inadvertently with like a random post, and then I kind of liked the tag itself. And so sometimes I do about the real pixels and my interaction with designers and the crazy things that they ask from us. Hey, you know, I just had this idea, and then it like this crazy in effects video that like, no. And sometimes it's in general like stuff that is happening in the tech industry or whatever happens like, you know, in the life of a geek.
Mm. But you've also got another series where you'll interview Hollywood people, right? Yeah, that's also pixel pushing. So basically, it's just it's the only word you've created, and so you're basically dumping everything into it.
Yeah. You know, I love when people take that tag and share their own experiences throughout the day. So I'm looking at you, and you haven't done any.
I have not
used. He's just afraid of the royalty payment for that.
Yeah, I thought it was wholly owned by your corporations.
For now, it is free. Okay. I'm considering the business models. It's been under consideration.
Okay, we can discuss a licensing.
So speaking of terms, I always catch myself. I call it the market still. What do you guys on the team, what do you refer to the Play Store as? Is it the market? Is it the store? Is it the Play Store? Do you have an internal code name?
It's just a name. I call it Play Store.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it's as far as I'm concerned, it's just like the same. Even if you look at the package name, like we started with com.android.vending, which is like vending for vending machine, where we're like, you know, you sell stuff, you buy stuff, and you cannot, unfortunately or fortunately, I don't know, Diane would be the best judge of it, you cannot change the package name. Once it's there, it's there. And so we kind of stuck with the old package name, and but it's just a name. We call it Play Store.
Okay.
Vending machine is the thing that you shake and you rock when the chip bag is stuck in the middle on the little coil. So I think it's appropriate.
So, you know, maybe you can break the store and get stuff for free. We'd love to know about that and close those loopholes.
Well, that's like, you know, some apps let you shake it and then it generates like a feedback thing. It's kind of the same principle.
Okay.
Is there a question?
No, never. All right, so what else we got? Oh, I did want to point out earlier, too, when we were talking about testing and you have QA people that have older devices, until this week, you were actually known for still carrying around a Nexus S, which we always thought was really cute, but it was actually a really good idea for people with these applications that scale across these multiple devices and releases. It was important for you to actually be running older releases that you cared about, right? Because if everybody is running, you know, Nexus 5 with latest release, they're not necessarily seeing the experience of most of your users because they haven't necessarily caught up to you yet.
Right, and I'm not going to go too deep into the personal reasons why I was still carrying Nexus S, but in general, if you target if you have a certain minimum requirement, if you're writing a game or pretty much any software development and you set up this is my minimum requirements, you should really test how your app is working on that minimum required platform.
I remember the same dynamic back when we used to write desktop software was that all the people writing the software, writing the platform, had these monster machines.
Yeah, like $2,000 NVIDIA card.
Yeah, yeah. And so you're writing on the best of the best, and you're like, hey, yeah,
this is like Apple, two frames per second
great.
On my Intel embedded graphics card.
Yeah. Real people don't necessarily have those pieces of equipment.
Yeah, but in general, if you get to run it on a device that is not as powerful as the latest ones, so first of all, on previous platform releases, if you start using some kind of a new API, it's better to catch that crash on like no such method error or whatever as soon as possible, not wait for your testers. Or like, you know, you send it to however many Googlers are in your last test round and then suddenly it starts crashing for them. So it's like, it's bad. So the sooner you can catch those primitive crashes, the better.
Or again, just use the support library no crash class.
Mm, yeah. Well, support library can get you like it doesn't wrap all possible APIs that you guys are adding in Jelly Bean and KitKat. So sometimes you just say, okay, like there's nothing in the support library. I'm going to guard it with a version check.
So do you ever look to external software? So you were talking about animation. I know Jake Wharton from Square does a lot of open source stuff, and he did one around. He did Action Bar Sherlock. And in order to do Action Bar Sherlock, he needed some basic animation capabilities and released some old
Androids.
Yeah, he
had 9Patch, what was it called? 9Patch something? Backporting the stuff you did in Honeycomb?
9 old Androids.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So he backported some of those animations,
right.
Extracted those.
Right, and he found a way to basically hack the old animations to make it look the same. It doesn't behave the same because there are platform capabilities that the animations depend on. But he got something that would basically allow you to use newer animation APIs that scale to older releases. Do you look at using things like that, or is it safer, you know, for Google apps to simply have internal dependencies?
Well, you know, it's a touchy area that involves scary lawyers. because like licenses and you have to really know what you're doing. And,
yeah.
But in general, we didn't find any particular reason to use a lot of third-party apps.
Yep.
So we used to have, we used to use a JMonkey engine. And as long as our lawyer people say that, yes, the software, like you put this license somewhere accessible in your settings menu. And but in general, I think that the Android platform itself, once again praising your team, is more than capable that if you don't stray too far away from the platform guidelines, you can manage it in-house with a relatively small team. And you don't need to use many third-party libraries. But that's like, you know, it would, it's kind of like based on specific requirements from our app. So if you look at other apps, the story might be different.
And I know that we work on some libraries as well. So hopefully we'll have a future conversation with Ficus talking about Volley,
right.
Which is...
It's a network library with some built-in caching.
I forget how it's provided.
It's part of most probably under Apache license, but once again, I don't want to do the whole. It's a network library with built-in caching for fetching stuff over the network and like various dispatches and different techniques.
And we'll leave it there because I want to tease.
This was a teaser, exactly. Right. We don't want to give away.
So let's talk about that, and I'll cut him.
Actually, you mentioned earlier that you know your best part of your day is when you're actually doing pixel-related painting code.
Yep.
What would you say is the most challenging part of doing UI development?
I think it's source control. I'm not a tools person.
I know.
So I know it's a touchy subject for Tor because he's the tools guy. But in general. Anything that takes the time away from like thinking about pixels and putting them on screen and testing them is just time wasted as far as I'm concerned. So you know people talking about this is my favorite version of Linux, or this is my favorite IDE, or this is my favorite version control, which can do 20% more than your favorite version control, is just so inconsequential to me that pretty much any time that I spend there is a waste of my day. So we can go deep on that, but it's like not related to like you know Android development. But in
general, what about within UI development? Is there anything there that's challenging, or it's all easy, or what? Like, is there something you're particularly proud of that you've done UI-wise?
I think most challenging is pretty much anything related to network and persistence. Because network, once again, like Chad mentioned, that pretty much all three of us came from the world of desktop, mm-hmm. where you have these beefy machines and they are connected to Ethernet, where it, like the connectivity is like 100% guaranteed. And now we are in the world of mobile, where you have unfortunately very primitive hardware capabilities, if you just compare it to these gigantic boxes like Mac Pro and whatnot. So you have to be very aware of the network, the CPU,
right.
and whatnot.
So in the middle of your painting code, if you make that socket call synchronously, that's might be bad for UI frame rate.
Yeah, it's like Google Earth has stopped, so you don't want to see that. Oh, Earth is not responding, so you don't want to see that dialogue. So in general, like there's all this, like, you know, sometimes I think about it as this iceberg where like 5% of the pixels are floating above the surface. And then you have the 95% of the scary code that can like sink you, where all the database, network caching, data mapping, data binding lives. So that kind of, whenever I need to drop into those layers to kind of, hey, you should own this feature end to end. So that's the annoying part of my day, but it's just part of our job.
Fortunately, the icebergs are currently melting, so all of that stuff is coming up to the surface. It should be much easier. So let me see. There's probably a lot of things that we haven't talked about, but I can't think of any. Anything else you wanted to bring up about?
No, you guys
Play
have
Store,
all of the good questions.
Scaling apps, scaling devices, your history.
We kind of mentioned about like I'm not going to go like into technical details, the specific resource qualifiers or whatnot. But in general, I think if you're an Android developer, you should really know your way around the resource qualifiers. Like that would be Apart from activity lifecycle, that I'm pretty sure Dan is the only person who knows that lifecycle. Like the resource qualifiers are like the if you're doing pixels in Android, that should be like you like somebody should like wakes you up in the middle of the night and asks you a question. You should first ask who the hell are you, and then and then like answer the question.
Okay. All right, resource qualifiers makes me feel like maybe I should go back to my office and learn more about
and activity lifecycle.
Yes, well, you already explained that nobody knows except Diane.
Yeah, that's job security.
All right, well, thanks for coming.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me, and see you next time.
All right.